I hate most about caring for this beast. I unchain her so I can move and roll her over, make sure she gets no bed sores, and prep to change her dressing gown. Also, deal with her catheter. This is a vulnerable time. She's unchained, but I'll work fast. It's absurd to think I'm vulnerable. She's in a drug coma. But is she? Is she? The light in here is natural today. I haven't flicked on the overhead, no need. I prefer the mellow amber, as God intended, indoors and out. An even, sedate amber, yes, is nice, but it is ruined by the stench of her sweat. So now it feels like dead amber. This psycho ruins everything. Is there anything worse than having to change her vile catheter? Nothing. Why do I do this to myself? I should stop feeding her. Put a pillow over her blob face, bury her behind the barn as I planned, along with... Fuck this. I've been thinking about it for weeks now, months. Mop hasn't noticed the two-people grave I've been digging out behind the back of the barn, beyond the hedge of brambles. The bitch needs to go. But Mop has seen her. Mop will ask questions. Mop is a problem. When she's back from Cape Cod, I need to deal with her. I guess I'm gone now. A different person, lost to who I was. I'm a plotter, and for no reason. Now, stop. Fight. You can be better again. Mop will help you. Maybe Mop wants to turn me in. Does Mop want to turn me in? If Mop turned you in, you'd get the help you need. This is no way to live. I'm staring at the wall in the side room, the side with the boarded window. Dipshit bitch is still out cold, but I swear she flinches when I touch her. I'm almost sure she's faking. I need my instruments by the boarded window. I'll test a few things. I move around the foot of her medical bed, stand before the boarded window. What's that? Was that flashing outside? So clear. The flashes cut through a crack in the boards and through this sedated amber room, white on yellow. I'm peering through cracks between boards. I can't see much at this angle, and with such a little space for viewing, but as I squint to perfect my limited vision, I'm sure. Yes, indeed. From high in my house, in the attic where Johanna sits in the rocker, yes, there come flashes of light. Johanna is signaling her flashlight. I love yous? To whom? I look closer, squinting and squishing my face for vision of my front door through this crack. Mop. My God, that's Mop, looking up at the attic from outside. She's back from the Cape early. Oh, no, oh, no, oh, no, she'll find Johanna. She'll never understand. I need to get there. Explain. Hey, bitch, comes her voice behind me. She was awake. She is awake. Oh, shit, she's awake. She's still unchained. That's right, bitch, you heard me, she says to my back. I'm wedged between her on the bed and the window, which I face. She should be unconscious on the hospital bed. She's unchained. Oh, God, no, she's unchained. The sheets scratch the still air with her quick movement on the bed. The bed shakes, the metal scratching the floor. Sounds like she's positioning and steadying herself on her knees. You fucking bitch. Yeah, you bet. I've been awake for months, exercising my muscles when you're not here. Been waiting on a perfect time, when I'm unlocked too long and you're distracted and here's my chance. As I turn, she jumps from the bed and out of the room. Gray clouds in my mouth. I can't breathe. I round the end of the table and realize I stalled too long in gray clouds. She's returned, and she's armed. The hatchet swings. Thwack! Hits my skull. I'm falling. Hit the rails of the hospital bed along the way. Unsure of my injury, I'm seeing only black and warping light. What a merciful release. My insanity fades, and sanity is attained in this white, white light. What drips from my brow? What liquid cascades down? I do not care.
Chapter 25. Mop. Present time. Everything fell apart fast after the woman in the barn entered the attic with Auntie's hatchet, bloodied. I don't know how she knew to find my companion and me here. Perhaps she heard us. Maybe Auntie narrated to her as she attended her rounds, giving away her sister's condition in the attic. Auntie doesn't realize how she talks aloud, her inner thoughts. I also didn't then know where Auntie was, or what this woman did to her with that bloody hatchet. The woman entered, blood splattered on her white and blue dressing gown, eyes wild and crazed, and demanded I unlock my mother's ankle from the bed. She held the hatchet over her head as her motivating force. If I were to believe in such things, I might believe that the witchcraft that raised my mother's body from the sea came with consequences, such as attendant evil as embodied in this bloody hatchet-wielding woman. Like in Pet Cemetery, when the dead child rises from the grave as a tricked blessing, for he's depraved and soulless and slices Achilles' heels, literally and figuratively. But I don't believe in such things. I don't accept today, one day later, although she lies upon my legs passed out, the hurricane rioting above, that this companion of mine is my mother. She is awakening, out here in the hurricane, a day after I found her. She arches her torso like she's posing cobra in yoga. "Mop," she says, without the slur she had when she first said my name in the attic. Yesterday, the hatchet woman burst in on me finding my companion alive in the attic. Everything was quick, but then prolonged and bizarre after that. It feels like the last day has lasted 10 years. What she put us through, the depravity, the insanity, what I've seen and heard in the last day, I will never be the same. I can either choose to remain at the bottom of my own inner well, lost, or I can grow strong and resolute. I have no other choices. Such trauma means I'll be planted in one of those extremes. I fight for the latter. I fight for strength and conviction.
"Unchain her and walk to the barn,"
Crazy Hatchet screamed at us in the attic. She hoisted the hatchet high above her head, ready to strike. Thankfully, the ring of house keys I snatched from the pink birdhouse had one for my companion's ankle chain lock. I carry walked her, slow and gentle, down the stairs, while Crazy Hatchet followed on our heels, laughing every time we tripped.
"She can't walk well, and I'm the one who had no PT. Weak Vandenbeer. A mutts mix of races, really. Mutts, all of you fucking Vandenbeers."
I have no idea what she meant by any of this. I concentrated on getting my companion to the barn. I didn't ask where Auntie was. I didn't want to know. But Crazy Hatchet offered anyway. After we reached the center of the barn, by way of the unchained front barn doors, for it appeared Crazy Hatchet disrupted Auntie mid-rounds, Crazy told me to sit my companion and myself on the floor of the barn in the center. Two stalls to our right, two to our left. Next, she tied my arms behind my back with quarter-inch rope. Then my companion's, then our legs. Next, she duct-taped our mouths. I had to comply because she kept the hatchet out of my reach and stood between me and my companion, who was too weak to stand and run on her own. If I didn't comply with being tied, I wouldn't have been able to save my companion from a hatchet swing.
"Do you know where Lynette Viola Vandenbeer is?"
Crazy Hatchet sing-songed, standing and lording over us while we sat on the concrete barn floor. I shook my head in fast micro-movements, as if shivering in a sub-zero freezer. "Oh," she said, puffing out her chest and standing tall, as if my answer truly surprised her.
"Okay,"
she said, and turned and walked over to the shipping crate stage in the corner, the one Manny and I used to use. As she wore a blue and white hospital gown tied in the back, the fabric didn't cover her spine or naked ass crack.
"Your aunt's dead. Over there."
She pointed with the hatchet toward the side room, her back still to us, and nonchalant. My companion gasped and gagged under her duct tape. I stared on. I didn't know what to believe. I wiggled my toes in my companion's ribs to tell her I was here with her and to be quiet. She seemed to get the message and swallowed her tears. The bond between mother and daughter has been proven to be interweaved at the literal cellular level. Pieces of my mother's biology are in me, and, true fact, pieces of my cells are in her brain, racing around in the neurons of her mind. Perhaps this is why I struggled at such a profound and disturbing level in trying to accept her death, for I knew in my body and soul and mind, cells and breath, it was not true. Crazy Hatchet dragged the stage closer to us in center, and as she did, the prop box atop shifted, and the sailing sails curtains swayed. "What's in this box?" "Hmm?" she said, calm, disconnected to the fact that blood soiled her dressing gown. She fingered the hatchet by her side, rocked bare feet like a savage, and held two women in ropes and duct tape in the center of a barn. In flipping off the lid, she shook her head and poofed, as if indicating what she saw was obvious. "My dress and underwear." "Of course." She held her find for us to see. That awful hand-stitched navy blue-on-blue gown I saw her wear 2 years ago on the rocks. As she pulled it from the box, rust-red and brown bloodstains blotched both blues. She extracted her dress and underwear from the prop box, lumping them on the floor of the stage, and then sent forth a horrifying laugh. How her shrieking laugh reverberates to me now, one day later, as I scrape my fingernails into the muddy dirt outside the burned basement, trying to lift my body off the ground while a woman in black holds Crazy Hatchet in a standoff by aiming a nail gun at her face. That shriek, hereby the hole, cuts through thunder, slices sideways rain, so shrill and insane. And yesterday she sure did shriek in her laughter on that sailing sails curtained stage. My and my companion's shoulders rose around our ears to muffle the painful screech. Nothing worked. Then she stopped, yanked her bloody hospital gown off, pulled on the dried blood homemade gown, and hiked up her yellow underwear. After pacing the stage like an inpatient in a corner of an asylum's rec room and staring dumb-like with dead eyes to a pigeon in the rafters, cooing at him in a lethargic bird language as he flew beam to beam, she plunked on her ass in a pfft, landing in a thud on the shipping crate stage. Fist to chin and elbow to thigh, she sat staring at me and my companion, blinking every few seconds. For several endless hours, as in the remainder of the day and into the night. She stared and stared, and we could do nothing, say nothing. Well, that's not entirely true. I was doing something with my feet. At some point around 7-ish, I'm guessing, based on the lower lighting, my iPhone rang in my back pocket. All day it had been vibrating with text messages I knew had to be from Manny, wondering where I was. So I knew that sometime around dinner he'd call, concerned. And indeed he did. Before Crazy Hatchet could explode, as her immediate red face and jerk of the head indicated she would, I shook my head in a way to tell her it was okay.
"Where's your phone?"
she thundered. But like a dentist, she asked a question to a patient without the ability to answer back. Realizing this, she scooched her ass across the stage and stood, her wacko dress scrunched up as she did, revealing her yellow underwear. She stomped over to me, pushed me face first into the concrete, and since I couldn't brace my face and not wanting to break my nose, I turned my head, forcing my cheek to crack on the concrete. Fishing around in my ass, she found my phone. It rang and rang and rang.
Says Manny. Who's that?
She yelled. Still, I could not answer. She ripped the duct tape from my mouth.
Who is Manny? Will he be looking for you?
Yes. Yes, he will look for me if I don't answer, I said, because I did not want Manny coming here looking for me. I didn't want him hurt by this awful woman. I needed to get a message to him to not come, and bonus, if I could send a coded message to call the cops.
Ha! You think I'm an idiot. You're not going to answer or send him a message. How hilarious!
And that shriek again. Oh, how it cuts my soul in long strips to remember. So high, so evil and aching. He will start looking for me soon, I pleaded.
Whatever. I'm not dumb. All you young bitches think I don't know technology. I'll text him back for you. He's the one you were fucking against the side of the barn the other day. I get it.
Sitting next to me on the concrete, taunting me with the phone in her hands, she showed me every move she made on my phone, as if I were her best friend in the world, surfing the internet for hot guys together. She waited out the ringing, and presumably Manny left a message. Then she went to my text screen and easily found Manny's last message.
Mop, aren't you coming back for dinner? Pick up. I'm starting to worry.
Then she wrote back as if she were me. Staying at my aunt's tonight. She's sad. I'll call in morning. Don't worry. My only hope was that Manny would detect the problem with the text. The fact that I referred to Auntie as my aunt, which I had never done before. He should have remembered that I always called her Auntie, like a proper name. But wasn't it delusional hope? That he'd somehow jump to the unbelievable conclusion that I was being held by a madwoman with a hatchet in my aunt's barn? Indeed. Delusional, strained, contrived. Telepathy offered better odds, and I can't perform telepathy. He'd never come to that conclusion about the text. Crazy Hatchet replaced the duct tape and took my iPhone back to the stage, and spent the whole night reading the internet, interjecting surprise, although subdued and apathetic, at stories she missed in her confinement in Auntie's barn. She'd pfft and say, of course, or I knew it, to whatever news she read, revealing the high opinion she held of herself. She knew all and all possible outcomes. So superior of knowledge. An omniscient, doubt-free being in a bloody gown. She regaled us, too, with celebrity obituaries, and ended each reading with a high, scratching, rattling laughter that shreds my soul to remember. At around, guessing here, maybe 1 in the morning, my companion passed out on my legs, which was a good thing, for her body covered my working feet. Chapter 26. Mop. Present Time. This morning, we awoke on the floor of the barn to the sounds of weak moaning from Auntie in the side room. I still didn't know her condition. I guessed it was bad, based on the blood on Crazy Hatchet's discarded hospital gown. I and my companion stirred on the floor. I hadn't realized I'd fallen asleep until screeching awoke me.
You die!
Hatchet yelled from the stage, cranking her head toward the side room, through which we could not see, for the doorway was down the wall away from us. But Auntie's moaning continued. Crazy Hatchet again scooched off the stage, stomped into the side room, and what I heard next curdled my soul. My companion stiffened and shook on my legs. A thwack, thwack, clatter and cling of metal beat down upon the moaning, a fleshy metal thwacking, until the moaning stopped. Next came an exaggerated throat clearing, deep inhale and forceful spit.
"No more from you, whore,"
Crazy Hatchet said in the side room. And when she reappeared before us, fresh blood splattered her blue-blue gown and sprinkled her face and hair. My companion sobbed under her duct tape, convulsing on my legs. I stared up at the woman who just beat my aunt to a very presumed death with the metal bedpan in her bloody hands. She bounced her weapon in one palm, holding it with the other. Blood plunked down and splattered in front of me. The woman ignored my companion and addressed only me.
"I've been thinking all night," she said, grinding her teeth in a literal and loud way, like trying to scrape ink paper for a dentist fitting your mouth for implants. "And I have to kill you both. You know that. I can't have any witnesses, and it's perfect. Makes a perfect three. You, your mother, your aunt. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
She said in a trailing of thoughts she seemed to have with herself. She lowered her head to us on the floor.
"But you deserve to know what happened that night 2 years ago, and why I will shut you and your dumb mother up forever. Because I can't be blamed. I can't be framed. That's what I've decided. And you need to know why. So we're going to have a play. Manny won't be coming to see Boo Hoo. He tried to come here last night, but I stopped him. He's dead behind the barn now. Right there, right out back," she said, pointing with a lazy arm to behind the barn. "So you have no reason to live anymore, bitch. And you will watch my play and then die. Boo fucking hoo."
She turned to her stage and readied items she'd set up, mumbling to herself a chant.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
My mother used to offer cushioned warnings about how Auntie Liv would sometimes have outbursts or go catatonic and stare. She'd say this after catching me staring off into the middle distance. And when she did, she'd hug me and sit down by pressing on both my arms. "Baby cakes. You know your Auntie Liv, she gets quiet, too, and stares like this. Doctors say she can get catatonic. This is why she's a nurse, darling. She says the control and concentration helps her to stay straight. But this scares me. Are you okay?"
"Mom," I'd say. "I'm just thinking on a question raised in my book. That's all. Trying to figure on the answer."
"My smarty girl. My thinky thinker," she'd say, and kiss my nose. This morning, my companion mother couldn't sit me down and kiss my nose to break my catatonic state. I just stared, unable to begin the thought of Manny lifeless outside. An impossibility. Something I'd never agree to believe. My mother shook her body against my legs to nudge me to blink. But there was no way I'd blink first. Not before the bitch on the stage, who stared back. Who would be the victor in our now declared battle to the death? I told her with my eyes that I'd be the vicious victor. Whether out of defense or vengeance, I fixed upon destroying her. How dare she say such a thing about Manny? Manny could not die. He is eternal. Crazy blinked. I stared on. I turned off my thoughts on Manny, on her claiming to murder him behind the barn. I watched her as she moved around her stage, preparing herself for her one-woman play. No idea why she felt she had to show us what happened that night, the night of the fire. I only know that insanity creates fabrications of reason in each person's mind, so inexplicable to the outside, there can be no way to diagram any sort of rationale. I steadied myself to watch, so she would focus only on me watching and not on my feet. Calming my breath and lowering my eyes, I gave the appearance of meditation so intense Gandhi would be proud. This was this morning, and already the hurricane had started. Wind picked up outside the barn, not in the riotous way it is right now, at night, at the height of the storm, but in a rising strength. Enough to know that children would be at Ocean Lawn flying kites, higher and higher. Crazy Hatchet moved to the stage, still holding her hatchet, pointing the blade at me. A slap of wind shook the rafters. I continued my low-lid stare. She jabbed the air with the hatchet in my direction. My companion stiffened. This threat to her daughter stopped her crying. I could almost feel my companion embolden as only a mother can. A mother in protection. And yet, in that moment, this morning, I could not bring myself to look at her with daughter eyes in pleading, as a child begging for protection. For I could only accept her as a vessel of a human, no more than my companion. Crazy Hatchet flung one side of the sailing curtain farther open to reveal she'd set some items up in the night. Atop a cardboard box, she'd duct-taped a broke-neck balding doll in a sitting position. Manny and I used to employ this doll in our plays. Lexi Cat, we called her. A couple of the ubiquitous tissue rose petals from our Rose Thief Fox play stuck in her hair. Crazy had obviously extracted Lexi Cat from the prop box. She moved around, slump-shouldered and lethargic, as if this entire act, the self-imposed drudgery of her having to put on her show and her having to be in the barn with her hostages, bored her. "That's your bitch mother, Johanna Vandenbeer Pentecost, right there on your aunt's stove." I duct-taped her on the burners. "Remember, Johanna?" She addressed my companion this time and poofed out her lazy nonchalance. Her chronic poofing was a nervous tick. She indicated that the doll Lexi Cat, duct-taped to the cardboard box, was a rendition of my mother, duct-taped on top of Auntie's black gas stove. "Now I will play the role of me and your whore aunt slash sister," she said, nodding to me and then my mother. She blinked three times, slow, and seemed like she was grazing in a field. She swished the other sailing sail curtain farther open to reveal another box and a chair behind it. So a table and a chair and a basket of laundry on the box. She took three steps to the chair, sat, and started folding the laundry in the basket, underwear and towels. She hummed the mellow carnival tune of Paul Simon's America, the cadence one for a night spin on a slow carousel. "I was innocently folding the laundry in your aunt's kitchen, folding her underwear. Well, in threes," she said, adding her awful laugh as a distinct spike to the otherwise slow, bored monotone in which she spoke. I think my eardrums shriveled this time. I didn't need to analyze the insanity. To fold another woman's underwear in her kitchen after duct-taping her sister to the stove, this was something I held no doubts about. She hummed again. And now I don't think I can ever hear another Paul Simon song without thinking of a horror House of Mirrors. It's too bad, for he's a true poet. "Now," she said, standing. "Pretend I'm still sitting there, being good, folding her laundry." She towered above me from the stage, me still slumped, tied up on the ground of the barn. "And well, there I was, folding underwear, minding my business and humming." "Your mother, you, Johanna," she said, pointing the bloody hatchet at my companion, "were helping me concentrate by staying good and quiet and taped on the stove." "Yep," she said, swiveling around toward the laundry basket on the table and the phantom ghost of herself sitting there. Sashaying the blood-crusty skirt of her homemade dress, she continued.
So there I was.
At the edge of the stage, she paused, and in a slow, cautious bend, set her hatchet on the corner of the shipping crate stage, wormed her hand, still cautious, behind the folds in the curtains, and pulled one of Auntie Liv's yellowware bowls. She must have retrieved it from the house while I dozed off in the night. She bounced the bowl with one hand into the palm of her other, like she did the bedpan.
But in came your whore aunt and ruined everything. She beat me with a bowl.
Crazy Hatchet leaped toward the mock cardboard table so unexpected and fast, holding the bowl aloft in a gesture that she was about to beat her own shadow in the chair, that she miscalculated her steps, wedging her still bare feet in the slats of the shipping crate. A hush overcame the barn. I moved my ankles and feet faster. Had I been freed and full of my ankle tie, I would have taken my chance and run then. It's a good thing I didn't, for a million psychics would fail to anticipate what was about to happen next. A knocking at the barn's front door cut a quick hush in the barn. We must have missed it before. Hatchet's voice, and her shrill having masked it, and also masked the roll of the tires and quiet engine of the car in the driveway that preceded the knocking. We missed such noise given her consuming monologue and her spike of screeching laughter. And so, evil thwarted her own self. The barn door creaked open, then flung wide, and the bright morning sun invaded and blinded the darkened barn interior. Wind bent the highest part of the trees outside and loosened yard objects, such as Auntie's various garden flags. Flew about behind the man in a green coverall at the entrance. Also behind him, my red Volvo. The mechanic had come to return my Volvo. He'd said in a message somewhere in the last week that he'd drop it off when it was ready, and he'd walk the 3 miles back to the garage, for he liked this stretch of road. Being in the haze I'd been in over the last week, I hadn't called him back to warn him about the chains at the end of Auntie's driveway, and in that moment, looking up at him from the floor of the barn, I realized she'd unchained them on the night we ate pizza in Rye. She must have left them unlocked when she returned. I don't know why. I can only speculate on her lessening defenses. I assume he heard the commotion in the barn, knocked, heard more commotion, and opened the doors. Crazy Hatchet, about 20 feet from him, her leg wedged wrongwise in the shipping crate, didn't hesitate. So while he's startled at the sight he stumbled upon, his mouth wide open to see a bloody woman in a bloody gown, leg stuck in a make-do stage and 2 women on the floor tied and duct-taped, she snatched her hatchet on the cardboard box table and threw it like a master Indian hunter with such force and precise aim. It hit the mark on the center of his face and stayed. Auntie in the side room awaited her chance, too. At this very moment, she limp-crawled quick from her confinement and out, past the split mechanic and into the sun. From the crown of her dented head dripped blood, down onto her shoulders and torso like a red candle, melted of the flame. Auntie didn't turn to look at me and my companion. Didn't look at the mechanic. She crawled like a bloody animal, hands and knees on the seashells and pebbles in her driveway, and disappeared in shades of sunlight that blinded our darkened pupils. Growing hurricane wind lifted her gray hair, blending her in the coming storm. Crazy Hatchet went wild, screaming and screeching. You bitch! As if her voice would slow Auntie's slothful yet seemingly fruitful escape. Hatchet worked her leg, trying to free herself, And this is when I didn't waste another minor second on watching the mechanic twitch or animal auntie disappear into stormy sunlight. This was the best chance I'd get to haul out. I was not only desperate to free myself and my companion, but also desperate to check on the wellness of Manny. Now, tonight, in this hurricane, I bring myself to think of that moment. The seconds before standing, horror-struck I might find Manny dead behind the barn. This is something in thought so unbearable to me, as if I lost my own soul. My real soul, detached, dissolved, making me nothing but skin. This possible reality was so far beyond frightening. A fraction of acknowledging it diminished the horror of the scene in the barn and the tremendous risk I was about to take for me and my companion. But the time was prime. No better moment than when Crazy threw the hatchet at the mechanic and wailed and flailed about in a riotous furor over Auntie. I'd been waiting for something. Didn't know what. But that had to be the moment, and so I acted. Turns out, there is something I did learn. An invaluable and, turns out, practical, not metaphysical or philosophical lesson in tutoring those human trafficking refugees. Seems I did get their backstories. I was listening, storing their stories to the backup hard drive of my mind. One story flitted to the active hard drive of my mind during the time I sat tied in the barn. Pradina was one of the refugee sex trafficking victims I tutored. I coached her through a reading of my tattered copy of The Mummy Market, which is criminally out of print, for it's a classic. Pradina, a 16-year-old girl who dreamed of competitive swimming, was snagged from a corner in Honduras, about a 2-hour walk from her 200-square-foot shack in the mountains. She used to talk of a monkey who stole her breakfast banana and papaya bread every morning. So she walked hungry to the city factory in which she cleaned bathrooms. She did laugh about the monkey and her long mountain walk. So I assume part of her home life she did indeed mourn. I connected with Pradina over her wish to swim. In retrospect, the perspective she gave me was a 1,000-volt lesson on privilege. How I shouldn't waste it, and how I should spread my born-into gifts. Pradina had thousands of roadblocks and hurdles just to be able to find a muddy pond in which to swim one lap, whereas if I wanted to swim competitively, I need only train off the coast of 2 estates, in one of 2 rye pools, Princeton's pool, and register in any race among thousands of options. Pradina had been tied behind her back and at the ankles once, after being held for 3 months in a literal pit and raped every day by a man named Stink. Stink was known as the prep cook, charged with preparing victims for a trafficking ring's trade. On the day the ring was set to transfer Pradina to another pit, Stink tied her up, like an animal about to be thrust in a pile for a barbecue. Pradina said people tied as such waste their energy on the hands, trying to de-knot with fingers. But to Pradina's teachings, your legs are powerful trunks of muscles. And if you're tied at the ankles like she was, like I was, best to keep flaring the heels out and out. This option is usually undetectable and will loosen the rope fibers while also working up lubricating sweat. In her case, her legs were lazily tied together, as were mine, one rope around both ankles, not crossed in the middle. This parallel between Pradina's and my ankle tying gave me confidence to focus on my ankles and nothing else. Do not focus on the horror of what happened or the fear of what is to come. Focus only on the best activity with the best potential to escape. This will give you your greatest asset, a sense of control, and thus the greatest chance to win, Pradina had said. focus and stay on course with that one activity. Truly, it is mind over matter.
Her words echoed to me in the barn like ancient verse, prophetic advice, divine direction.
There are no words more pure than Pradina's.
In this, I do believe.
In Pradina's story,
about an hour or two into her truck ride from one pit to another, her right heel wormed out. With her legs free, she scooted to the end of the open bed of the moving truck, and when slow enough, jumped, rolled down an embankment, and ran with her hands tied for 4 hours through jungle and farmland.
The best part of Pradina's story was how she rested on a rock on the edge of jungle and open field.
Dozing for a second, she was awakened by the sound of scraping down the tree behind her.
A monkey, with nimble fingers, worked the loosening of the rope on her wrists and took her rope, scurrying back up the tree, freeing Pradina's hands. When she thought the hero or thief, whatever he was gone, a banana dropped from the canopy above. Where his monkey face appeared through the thickness of leaves, and his monkey hands poked out to dangle his stolen rope. He either paid Pradina for the rope with a banana, or mocked her.
She ate the banana, thinking of her monkey in the mountains, and how this hero, thief, brother monkey might be part of the monkey network, and this was the network's way of saying thanks for all those stolen breakfasts back home.
Thereafter, Pradina somehow found a missionary who connected her with the UN. I'm not sure of the legalities, they aren't the point. As for Pradina's belief in a network of brother monkeys and nature's connection to all, I did fall into her belief when she told me the story. But then I pushed it away as fantasy. But today, I see Pradina's wisdom, and I agree with her fantastical belief. Nature saved Pradina, and nature would save me. I believed.
I believe.
This morning, I finished working my ankles while I wished for a nimble-fingered brother monkey to untie my wrists. Pradina's story lent me the forethought to forego my hands and focus all my energy on my feet. She gave me hope. She gave me focus.
I did what Pradina did.
But I had it better than her. I had my mother's beach glass stall right behind me. My mother had done the same as me, for when I nudged her a couple of times as a way to say, "Do what I'm doing," she listened to the message of a daughter's touch.
The second Crazy Hatchet loosened herself from the stage, limp springing, I think she broke an ankle, toward the open barn doors, toward the mechanic or auntie, I'm not sure. I sprang and ran to the beach glass stall, and my companion did too.
My companion. My mother. My love.
With my hands still tied in back, I grabbed my mother's wire cutters, fished the point end into my back pocket, and nodded my duct-taped mouth to my companion, indicating we needed to run for the back barn door, which was closer to us than to Crazy Hatchet. We made no mistakes of hesitations and ran for the back door. Auntie had failed to rebar the back, or Crazy Hatchet had unbarred it, or Manny had. And if the last were true, that lent to Crazy's story that he was dead. I shook to push the back exit and find it unbarred. My body did not hesitate to escape, but my mind held back, afraid to find Manny lifeless. Something bit me in the calf on the way out. It was not until we were in the sunlight that I realized she'd flung her hatchet clear across the barn at me, having retrieved it from the mechanic. The only fortunate part of the blow was that the distance thrown diminished the force. Had she been closer, my leg would have been severed. I scoured behind the barn for Manny, ignoring the searing pain in my leg. The competing needs to escape and find Manny distracted me from collecting the hatchet in the doorway. My frantic search was fast and thorough.
for my companion and I had no time to lose. There was no disturbance behind the barn. No body, no fingerprints, no broken plants, no moved bricks, nothing. So Hatchet either lied, or many lay elsewhere. From within the barn, I heard a scowling howl.
"Let me go!"
Hatchet screamed. Then a thud, which I presume was her falling. Perhaps the mechanic grabbed her ankle in his last dying act. Maybe Auntie returned. Maybe one was our hero. I don't know. But whatever happened within the barn, the thudding, the scraping, yelling I heard, allowed enough time to lapse for me and my companion to make it to the burned-out basement hall, jump into the false door, nearly breaking our legs in the fall, for we couldn't use our tied hands to climb down. Underground and hidden, I wormed the wire cutters from my back pocket, turned my companion around by directing her with head nods, turned my back to her back, and clipped with care at her wrist ties. Once free, she removed the duct tape from our mouths and cut me free. Then we worked to tie a tourniquet around the bleeding hatchet wound on my calf, using the kerchief holding her hair back, and shivered together in disbelief, grief, mournful reunion, blood loss, muscle fatigue, hunger, thirst, and fear. All day went by. We did not speak. She was weak, and we didn't want our voices to carry on the wind. And besides, about 10 minutes in, about when I thought we could test our luck, haul out, and escape to Manny's, my companion passed out. I couldn't carry her out. We were stuck. And having been separated from her for what felt like an eternity over 2 years, there was not a chance I would test the waters on my own without her. The wind whipped up as the day bore on, and the witch woman yelled along with the wind in search of us. If you didn't know there was a hidden hatch door, you wouldn't know we could get underground, so I believe she passed by our spot, which is hidden by vegetation several times. I believe she scoured Auntie's house 10, 20 times. Now, I wait in an impossible hope for Auntie to somehow save us in her death state. All day in the hole, every single damn time my companion awoke and I thought I could convince her to use all her strength and follow me out, Crazy Hatchet's voice would near and kill the plan. And 10 minutes later, my companion would again pass out. All day, cycles like this. The sounds of Hatchet bleeding to us underground, above the increasing winds. By some miracle, the blood from my wound had collected in my scrunchy sock and my sneaker until I was in the hole, at which point it flowed all around until tourniqueted. So, no blood trail betrayed our whereabouts. Scraping, cycling, fitful winds sang songs of rising laments all day and into the night. I begged the ocean goddess to save us. My companion dozed in and out of consciousness, her head in my lap.
Chapter 27, Auntie. Earlier today. I'm lying on the floor of my barn's side room. You're lying on the floor of your barn's side room. She's hatcheted my skull. She's beaten me with a bedpan. I've entered my death process. I'm dying. You're dying. I won't. I can't. I won't. You can't. Let Mop and Joanna die. I won't. You won't. Give in to this lovely darkness. I won't fail. You won't fail. I can't fail. You can't fail. To make the call this time. It won't be like with Daddy. No great clouds of moldy cotton. Only darkness awaits me after I finish this one last necessary task. That is all. I just need to crawl into the light, now flooding, a man standing in the mouth of light. He's in green. Perhaps he's the gravedigger. He's opened a door for me to crawl out and find a phone. And then darkness may shroud me. Go, now. Crawl out, now. I need to go now and crawl out, now. With the aches of 1,000 flus and every virus I've ever had, my muscles tight and resisting, inflamed they feel under my fire skin, I press up to palms and knees and push. I'm an animal, all right, dying and draining, muscles failed and failing, forward pressing, repeat. A rising fire in my throat foretells of retching. I pass the gravedigger in his green suit. He's on the floor now. I keep going. Pulsing virus balls ache within my body. Blood flows anew from the gash in my skull and covers my dead eye socket in a liquid mesh. Get in the house, the cordless in the library, and then you'll be best positioned in there to spring your pre-made grave. Save them. Spring the grave. In a limited range of movements, in one confined room. Triage. Efficiency. I'm a nurse. You're a nurse. I press on through my foyer. I believe screaming or wind or both is behind me. Blood drops from my face to my white marble foyer. The library. Turn right. I turn right and enter the library. The cordless under my Roosevelt gun. Perfect. The cordless under your Roosevelt gun. Perfect. I can't let Mop and Johanna die. I won't let that happen. With my literal last breath, I must make the call. I will not fail this time. Not like with Daddy. You cannot fail this time. Not like with Daddy. No gray clouds. No loss of consciousness. Fight. Fight. I press. Keep pressing. My muscles pulse up on my inner skin, breaking through fat and cartilage. I nudge the table with the cordless, with my bloodied head. Next I ram harder, using every ounce of strength remaining. The cordless drops to the floor beside my right hand. Thank goodness the batteries didn't pop out. And now, with that motion, the remote to the CD player falls too. Blood from my skull drips on the phone and CD player remote. With the last ounce, as in it hurts so much to do this, requiring so much effort, I gag, cough, and choke to near final death. I press one button on speed dial. My hand then falls of its own will upon the remote, and Die Rose, always primed to play, blares from the speakers at full volume. As I listen to the forever ringing of my placed speed dial call, Die Rose plays on in instruments and foreign operatic words, and I recite the poem lyrics in English in my head. My eyes droop, my shoulders droop, my body is falling toward the floor. Oh, Die Rose, you accompany this never-ending falling to the floor, and the never-ending ringing of the phone. Your lyrics about a regretful rose about to die. The answering machine at Rye picks up after 9 million rings in eternity. But I am in free fall to the floor, and Die Rose is weaving knots of foreboding in my mind. I can't speak now, can't say a word to the woman who I know will listen to this recording first. She is far away from me now, 3 galaxies of telescoping darkness, maybe. And I am listening to the ting-ting of piano keys and opera poetry in some unknowable space, while I continue falling through my own floor, through the basement, the earth, and out beyond. But I know her. I know her secret. I know she's proud for what she did, despite being kicked out of the church for it. And I don't blame her. I'm proud for her, too. She's a relentless, tireless, constantly suspicious, headstrong woman. If anyone is going to figure out why I say no words, for I can't, it's her. I'll pass the baton to Aunt Sister Mary to save our shared niece, our girl, and save our Johanna. I wish I could scream, wish I could say the word help, but I can't. I couldn't dial more than one programmed button. If I could, I would have dialed 911. With my final breaths, which are shallow and nasal only, I send a wordless SOS to the only one who will agonize and overthink on the words unsaid. Leaving the phone line open, I try, although I know I'll fail, to crawl up the wall, which holds my glass-cased Roosevelt gun. If only I could crank down on the glass box and open my grave. Crawl out there and die in my intended death well. Above me would be my spiral of sunflowers, which I would command. And I would at once strip this ugliness and be pure power, beautiful power. Di Rosa has begun to play again. I think I must have set it to replay. Or perhaps it is the only song I will ever hear now, in my eternity.
Chapter 28. Mop. Present time. The woman in black, pointing the automatic nail gun at the chest of Crazy Hatchet, yells down to us through the pounding rain. Do not move, you two. I'm going to shoot her now. Don't move. Stay low. This is a moment of awe for me. Not because I waffle smack dab in the gray zone between conscious and unconscious, but because this is a literal physical show of an existential crisis. Never have I seen one unfold. All before were theoretical hypotheticals, suggestions of wars over personal morals, questions presented by philosophers and professors. But before me now, an ex-nun in black garb holds a nail gun at the chest of the woman with a hatchet in a hurricane. The pause it took for Aunt Sister Mary to speak her warnings to us to lie still on the ground was a pause during which Crazy Hatchet lowered her hatchet. And while she raised that hatchet high again when Aunt Sister Mary squinted in the rain to aim her firing, things didn't need to go down as they are going to go down. I think, although perhaps I'm delusional, but I'm sure the standoff could have ended in our favor without further bloodshed, had Aunt Sister Mary kept the pause and her gun lowered. But done with her warnings to us on the ground, her green eyes full of fire now, like the glow of flames mirrored in a Christmas ball, alive, glazed, possessive, possessed. Aunt Sister Mary Patience Pentecost shoots Crazy Hatchet with a spray of pressurized nails. Cha-cha, doosh, cha-cha, doosh, doosh, is the sound of nails sinking into the woman's chest, I think. I think they sink into her chest. Did they hit their mark? I can't believe she actually shot her. Aunt Sister Mary, of all people, is capable of violence. Capable of physical defense and protection. Revenge? Vengeful justice? She must really love us, for real, regardless of how this must weigh on her. She's a zealot. Aunt Sister Mary's eyes are wild and wide, but determined and relentless, and she does not doubt her action. She does not doubt what she's doing. She has unadulterated faith and conviction in protecting me and my companion. My mother. Aunt Sister Mary Patience Pentecost is trying to save me and my mother. My mother. My mother is alive. I believe this, for it is true. How did she know to come here? When I last saw her yesterday in Cape Cod, she stormed off, mad at me, and drove home early. I really hurt her, tweaking her for her secret on why she left the church. How did she know to come here? The rain is still a billion drills, and I suppose I shouldn't feel like it's been raining 20 hours. It's just that time is stretching too long and warped for me. I think, although it's hard to say, it's only been a couple of minutes since my mother and I emerged from the burned-out basement hole. Maybe hours. Time seems irrelevant.
Such a pedestrian theory in this otherworldly dimension, where the embodiments of religion and nature join forces and fight for us.